The House of the Dead, written by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Part 1. Chapter 1. 10 Years a Convict. Among the mountains and impenetrable forests of the Siberian desert, one comes from time to time across little towns of 1,000 or 2 inhabitants. They are built entirely of wood and are very ugly, with 2 churches, one in the centre of the town, the other in the cemetery. These places are, in fact, much more like good-sized villages on the outskirts of Moscow than towns properly so called, and are generally administered by an inspector of police, a body of assessors, and some minor officials. It is cold in Siberia, but the great advantages of government service compensate for that. The inhabitants are simple folk, without liberal ideas. Their manners are old-fashioned, solid, and unchanged by time. The officials who, of course, form the nobility in Siberia either belong to the country, deep-rooted Siberians, or have migrated from Russia. The latter come straight from the large cities, tempted by the high pay, the extra allowance for travelling expenses, and by hopes not less seductive for the future. Those who know how to adapt themselves to conditions in Siberia almost always remain there. The abundant and richly flavoured fruit which they gather recompenses them amply for what they lose. As for the others, light-minded persons who are unable to deal with the problem, they are soon bored in Siberia, and ask themselves with regret why they were so foolish as to come. They impatiently kill the 3 years for which they are obliged by their sentence to remain, and as soon as their time is up, they ask to be sent back and returned to their original homes, decrying and ridiculing Siberia. They are wrong, for it is a happy country, not only as regards the government service, but also from many other points of view. The climate is excellent. The merchants are rich and hospitable. The Europeans, in easy circumstances, are numerous. As for the girls, they are like roses, and their morality is irreproachable. Game is to be found in the streets and throws itself upon the sportsman's gun. People drink champagne in prodigious quantities. The caviar is astonishingly good and most abundant. In a word, it is a blessed land, out of which it is only necessary to be able to make profit, and much profit is in fact made. It was in one of these little towns, gay and perfectly self-satisfied, whose population left upon me the most agreeable impression, that I met an exile, Alexander Petrovich Goryanchikov, formerly a landed proprietor in Russia. He had been condemned to hard labour of the second degree for assassinating his wife. After undergoing his punishment of 10 years hard labour, he lived quietly and unnoticed as a colonist in the little town of K. To tell the truth, he was on the register of a neighbouring district, but he resided at K, where he managed to get a living by giving lessons to children. In the towns of Siberia, one often meets exiles thus engaged. They are not looked down upon, for they teach the French language which is so necessary in life, and of which, without them, no one in the distant parts of Siberia would have the least idea. I saw Alexander Petrovich for the first time at the house of an official, Ivan Ivanich Gvostikov, a venerable old man, very hospitable, and the father of 5 daughters, for whom the highest hopes were entertained. 4 times a week, Alexander Petrovich gave them lessons, at the rate of 30 silver kopecks a lesson. His external appearance interested me. He was excessively pale and thin, still young, about 35 years of age, short and weak, and always very neatly dressed in the European style. When you spoke to him, he looked at you most attentively, listening to your words with strict politeness and a reflective air, as though you had set him a problem or wished to extract a secret from him. He replied clearly and shortly, but in doing so weighed each word, so that one felt ill at ease without knowing why, and was glad when the conversation came to an end. I asked Ivan Gvozdikov about him. He told me that Goryanchikov was of irreproachable morals, otherwise he would not have entrusted him with the education of his children, but that he was a terrible misanthrope, who avoided all society. That he was very learned, a great reader, and that he spoke but little, and never entered freely into a conversation. Some people said that he was mad, but that was not looked upon as a very serious defect. Accordingly, the most important persons in the town were ready to treat Alexander Petrovitch with respect, for he could be useful to them in writing petitions. It was believed that he was well connected in Russia. Perhaps among his relations there were some who were highly placed, but it was known that since his exile he had broken off all contact with them. In a word, he was his own executioner. Everyone knew his story, and was aware that he had killed his wife through jealousy less than a year after his marriage, and that he had given himself up to justice, which had made his punishment much less severe. Such crimes are always looked upon as misfortunes, which must be treated with pity. Nevertheless, this extraordinary man kept himself obstinately apart, and never showed himself except to give lessons. In the first instance, I paid no attention to him. Then, without knowing why, I found myself interested in him. He was rather enigmatic. To converse with him was quite impossible. Certainly he replied to all my questions. He seemed to regard it as a duty to do so. But when once he had answered, I was afraid to question him further. After such conversations, one could observe on his countenance signs of suffering and exhaustion. I remember one fine summer's evening, leaving Gvozdikov's house in his company. It suddenly occurred to me to invite him to come in and smoke a cigarette. I can scarcely describe the fright which showed itself in his countenance. He became confused, muttered incoherently, gave me an angry look, then suddenly fled in the opposite direction. I was astonished afterwards when he met me. He seemed to experience, on seeing me, a sort of terror. But I did not lose courage. There was something in him which attracted me. A month later I called on Petrovitch without pretext, and it is evident that in doing so I behaved foolishly and without the least delicacy. He lived in one of the farthest points of the town with an old woman whose daughter suffered from tuberculosis and had a little girl about 10 years old, very pretty and very lively. When I entered, Alexander Petrovitch was seated beside the child, teaching her to read. When he saw me, he became confused, as if I had detected him in a crime. Losing all self-control, he jumped up and looked at me with awe and astonishment. Then we both of us sat down. He followed attentively all my looks, as if I suspected him of some mysterious intention. I realized that he was horribly mistrustful. He looked at me as if I were some kind of spy, and seemed to be on the point of saying, "Are you not going soon?" I spoke to him of our little town, of the news of the day, but he was silent, or smiled with an air of displeasure. I could see that he was absolutely ignorant of all that went on in the town, and that he was in no way curious to know. I spoke to him next of the country generally, and of its men. He listened to me in silence, fixing his eyes upon me in such a strange way that I felt ashamed of what I was doing. I apparently offended him by offering him some books and newspapers which I had just received by post. He cast a greedy look upon them, but seemed to alter his mind and declined my offer, giving his want of leisure as a pretext. At last I wished him good-bye, and felt a weight fall from my shoulders as I left the house. I regretted having harassed a man whose tastes kept him apart from the rest of the world, but the mistake had been made. I noticed that he possessed very few books. It was not true, then, that he read so much. Nevertheless, on two occasions when I drove past, I saw a light in his lodging. What could make him sit up so late? Was he writing? And if that were so, what was he writing? I was absent from town for about 3 months, and on my return in the winter, I learned that Petrovich was dead. He had not even sent for a doctor. He was already forgotten, and his lodging was unoccupied. I at once made the acquaintance of his landlady, in the hope of learning from her what her lodger had been writing. For 20 kopecks she brought me a basket full of papers left by the deceased, and confessed that she had already used 4 sheets to light her fire. She was a morose and taciturn old woman, and I could elicit nothing of interest. She could tell me nothing about her lodger. She gave me to understand, all the same, that he scarcely ever worked, and that he remained for months together without opening a book or touching a pen. On the other hand, he walked all night up and down his room, giving up to his reflections. Sometimes, indeed, he spoke aloud. He was very fond of her little grandchild, Katya, above all, when he knew her name. On her name-day, the feast of St. Catherine, he always had a requiem mass said in the parish church for somebody's soul. He detested receiving visits, and never went out except to give lessons. Even his landlady he looked upon with an unfriendly eye when, once a week, she came into his room to put it in order. During the 3 years he had lived under her roof, he had scarcely ever spoken to her. I asked Katya if she remembered him. She looked at me in silence and turned weeping to the wall. This man, then, was loved by someone. I took away the papers and spent the day examining them. They were for the most part of no importance, merely children's exercises. At last I came to a rather thick packet. The sheets were covered with delicate handwriting, which ended abruptly. It had perhaps been forgotten by the writer. It was the narrative, incoherent and fragmentary, of the 10 years Alexander Petrovich had passed in hard labour. The story was interrupted here and there by anecdotes or strange, terrible recollections thrown in convulsively, as if torn from the writer. I read some of these fragments again and again, and began to suspect that they had been written in moments of madness. But his memories of the convict prison, recollections of the House of the Dead, as he himself called them somewhere in his manuscript, seemed to me not without interest. They revealed quite a new world, unknown till then, and in the strangeness of his facts, together with his singular remarks on this fallen people, there was enough to tempt me to go on. I may perhaps be wrong, but I shall publish some chapters from this narrative, and the public may judge for itself.